Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is Matt Bennett. He's the co-founder and executive vice president for public affairs for a Washington think tank and advocacy organization called Third Way. It's dedicated to finding center-left approaches that have the potential to actually be enacted and to have an impact. And he's appeared on the program several times in the past. Matt, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me.
So you've got this argument now about 2020, looking toward the presidential election, that moderates are going to be the key to this if the Democrats are going to be successful in defeating Trump. If Trump loses, it will be because of the role of moderates. So tell me why – let's just start with the basic argument. Why and in what ways are moderates the keys here?
Well, I think what you'll find is that moderate voters will determine who the nominee is, and then moderate voters in the general election will determine who the president is. And the reason for those two things are somewhat different, of course, because the politics of the primary are very, very different than the general election. So let's look first at the primary.
Okay.
If you look at the things that Democratic voters have actually done with their vote, both recently in 2018 when they voted in the primaries in the midterm elections and over time in the presidential elections, they tend to vote for people that they view as the most likely to win. Electability, of course, is the thing that they judge these candidates by, and they tend not to go for people offering extremist views. So just a couple of examples of that. In 2004, the last time we had a large field of candidates running for the Democratic presidential nomination, we had a fierce fight in 2008 between Clinton and Obama. We had one in 16 between Clinton and Sanders. But the last time we had a bunch of people who were all real prospects to win the nomination was 2004. And what happened in 2004 was that Howard Dean jumped out to a very large lead in the summer of 2003 because the year before a presidential election tends to belong to the activists. Those are the people who are paying attention a year before an election. They're the people now who are engaged in social media. They're the people who are giving online. Back in 2004, there were the people that showing up at meetups. That was the kind of social media thing of the day. And Dean was generating a lot of excitement, a lot of money, and big crowds. And it looked like it was his race to lose. He was on the cover of Newsweek magazine, basically anointing him as the likely nominee. And in fact, that continued all the way through the period that we're in now, which is to say the fall and early winter of 2003. In December of 2003, there was a poll in Iowa, and it showed John Kerry at 9%. He was in sixth place. And that's because 2003 had belonged to Dean and the activists. Then we get to 2004, a month later, and Kerry comes from nowhere to win the Iowa caucuses and to go on and win the nomination fairly easily, despite having trailed so badly for a year. Because what happened in 2004 was that Democrats looked at the field. They looked at George W. Bush, the president, who was engaged kind of at the in this war that was extraordinarily unpopular. People really wanted a candidate that could beat Bush, and they went with the guy that they thought was the most likely to beat him. And they made that judgment on a whole bunch of levels, but one of them was Kerry was seen as fairly appealing to a broad swath of voters who would ultimately make the decision in the general election. And my view is that is likely to happen again. I don't know who that's going to be. There are a bunch of candidates that could end up with that mantle. It could be Biden. It could be somebody like Buttigieg or Klobuchar or Kamala Harris. But I think they're going to look at Senator Warren and Senator Sanders, and they're going to make, in some ways, judgments similar to the one they made about Dean, which is, this guy may appeal to me very much personally, but do I see people in the industrial Midwest voting for him next year? And they're probably, I think, going to say no. So ultimately, moderate voters will decide who the nominee is, whether that's in Iowa itself or later down the line. At some point, I think that's going
to
happen.
So let me jump in before you get to the argument about how they'll influence the general election, because you've said a couple things that, to my ear, seem counterintuitive. So I want to push you on them. The first one, and we're getting in the weeds here, but this is the danger of, I guess, a political scientist doing the interviewing. But I can remember the 2004 election, and you're absolutely right. I was at a political conference in the early fall of 2003, and every single political scientist on this panel that was looking toward the general election 2004 said that Howard Dean would be the nominee. All of them, every single one of them, they all got it wrong. But having said that, there are two questions that jump in my mind about this. One is, if we've learned anything from 2016, is that things may be different now. So you're looking pretty far back in time at a pattern, right? So why do you think 2004 is going to tell us something about 2020 when nothing really told us about 2016? And then the second question would be, there is this also general sense that primaries bring out those that are more on the edges. I mean, particularly in congressional primaries. And, you know, members of Congress will talk about this all the time. They're always worried about their flank, whether it's on the right or the left. So break it down why this is going to happen in the primary stage.
First of all, I will stipulate that very small data sets here. So who knows? Second, I got it wrong along with most of the rest of the universe in 2016. So predictions, take them for what they are worth. But the point you just made, I think, is vital. Yes, looking back at 04 is problematic because it's a long time ago. Let's look back at 2018.
Okay.
Last year. What happened in the 2018 cycle is because Democrats believed that they had an opportunity to get a bunch of pickups, which turned out to be true, that we picked up 7 governorships, we picked up 40 House seats, and lots and 400 some legislative seats. So there were incredible numbers of candidates. The number of women running, Emily's List, their numbers went up by something like 5x. So huge numbers of people running for all levels of government. And what you found was you had very large fields running in primaries. And almost everywhere where there was a truly competitive seat at risk, not in places where it was super dark red or super dark blue and there was simply no way to win or lose the general election, but in competitive seats where there was a far-left candidate running against a more mainstream or moderate candidate, the moderate won almost everywhere. However, there is an exception, as they say in law school, that swallows the rule, and that was in Queens. We all
right.
know.
AOC.
Right. So Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez knocked off Joe Crowley, a very, very powerful and senior member of the House Democratic Caucus, and that came to define what had happened in the primaries of 2018 in ways that truly distort what actually happened. So if you look at what actually happened in the competitive House races, the House New Democrats, who are the moderates, they won just about all of the races where their endorsed candidate was running against a far-left candidate, something like 88%. Whereas the far-left groups like Justice Democrats and Our Revolution lost almost all of those races. They won a few in the very red and blue places like Queens, but they lost the places that were competitive. And take a look at the governor's race in Michigan. So there we had Gretchen Whitmer, who was a very moderate, long-term state legislative and statewide leader running for governor in a primary against a very telegenic, very smart, very capable political leader who I think his name was El Sayed, who was endorsed by AOC and by Bernie Sanders. They came to the state to campaign with him. They were there for a week or something. All the outside groups gave to him, and the money poured in for him, and he lost every county in Michigan. She won by 22 points. Because the people of Michigan knew that they had the opportunity to take back the governor's mansion for the first time in 8 years, and they weren't going to blow it. They were going to find somebody that could win.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Matt Bennett, Executive Vice President for Public Affairs for the D.C.-based think tank Third Way. Okay, so that's the primaries. So now tell me why this same group is going to hold the key in the general election.
Right. And here, what we don't know is who they're going to choose. Because
right.
If you look recently, very recent New York Times polling in the battleground states of the upper Midwest or the industrial Midwest, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Florida also, what you found was the partisans are completely cemented into their corners. The liberals are going to vote for the Democratic not no matter what for all of them, but pretty much, the conservatives are going to vote for Trump almost no matter what. That means that those races, which were incredibly tight in some of those states in 2016, are almost certain to be incredibly tight again. And as Nate Cohn of the Upshot at the Times concludes, about 15% of the electorate in those states are true swing voters. They are people that have changed their vote from, in many cases, from 2016 to 2018, and they may change back again in 2020. So that group of 15% will decide the election, because it is very likely that the Democratic nominee will hold on to the Clinton states that we won in 2016. Minnesota is really the only state that a Democrat could even conceivably lose. And Trump is very likely to hold on to most of the states that he won in 16. The battlegrounds will be those six. There may be some others, depending on who our nominee is. It's conceivable Arizona, North Carolina will come into play. But for the most part, it'll be those six states. And those six states will be decided by that 15% in the middle. And the Times polling shows very clearly what tons of other polls have showed as well, which is those people are not ideologues. They are not interested in maximalist positions on either side. What they want are practical kitchen table solutions to the problems that they're facing every day. And if you look at the people who have succeeded in general elections, like Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan, it said on her lawn signs when she ran in 2018, fix the damn roads. Like, that is the kind of thing that Democrats need to be talking about. Not roads necessarily, but very practical solutions to real problems that people are facing right now. Not solutions that may strike some of those types of voters as kind of fantastical.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Matt Bennett. He's the co-founder and executive vice president for public affairs for the Washington, D.C.-based think tank Third Way. All right, so let's look into the future, and let's imagine that Trump is beaten, he loses. How will moderates then figure into what happens next?
It's a real open question now, because it really depends on who the new president is. Mm-hmm. If I'm wrong about the primaries and Senator Warren becomes the nominee, I think there's almost no chance of Sanders winning the nomination, but there's a pretty good chance that Warren wins the nomination. Much will depend on how she chooses to govern. And, of course, if you look at the way people campaign, the old saying is you campaign in poetry and you govern in prose.
Mario Cuomo,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, and that's really true. Oftentimes, things you talk about a lot on the campaign get pushed aside because of the exigencies of running the country. So my hope and expectation is that a President Warren would see real value in working with moderates in Congress and outside of Congress to try to advance some of the big things that she's talking about doing. I think we can probably stipulate that no one expects that everything that a candidate is promising is going to get done right away. I think things like Medicare for All are pretty far down the line. But there are plenty of things that moderates in Congress would be eager to work with a new president, whomever that is, to do, not only to restore some of the things that we believe Trump has broken, but to move the country forward in some fundamental ways. So I think if a President Warren were fairly open and magnanimous about working with everyone in the kind of progressive family, there could be a good relationship form there. If she decides that, no, she's going to kind of push for the you know, brass ring on everything, then it could get tense in ways that we've seen the Tea Party push back on Republican presence.
Yeah, on that point, I mean, it does seem like, let's imagine it's Senator Warren. It does seem like she's already pretty dug in at this point. And if she does become the nominee, it will be because those activists really pushed her over the top. And then if she becomes president, I think that would be the same lesson that people would draw and what she would be coming in. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine someone being able to kind of recalibrate to that degree, and particularly publicly, after you've kind of staked your whole case on a set of ideas and proposals that are much further out there.
Well, remember that the priority for her as a candidate is first to get something like 2,300 delegates, and then to get 270 electoral votes. And then if she were president, the priority is to win a majority in the House and, you know, 60 votes in the Senate. And those are very different things.
Right.
So let me just give you one scenario whereby you could see some real cooperation. She makes, you know, H.R. 1 is the Medicare for All Act, and it's passed by a Democratic House, and it sits forever and goes nowhere in a Republican Senate or a Senate that's basically 50-50. So she pushes hard, and she gives speeches, and she tries genuinely to move that forward, but stipulates that's going to be really, really difficult. And then there are other things she tries to do. Climate change, for instance. There is enormous agreement in the progressive coalition from far left to center left around the urgency of responding to climate change. And there's a lot of agreement about what we should do to do so. So I could certainly see a lot of cooperation around other things than the hot button issues that are in the primary.
So what does your argument about moderates suggest about the impeachment process? We haven't talked about that yet, but that's obviously the huge thing going on right now as you and I are speaking. So is there advice or concerns or risks that you see given that you've got this argument about the importance of moderates?
Well, I think the news there is pretty good. Nancy Pelosi has masterfully managed the various coalitions inside her broader caucus. And one of the things she did was she said no to the people pushing for impeachment before the Ukraine scandal arose. And she got enormous help from the moderates. There were, I believe, seven or nine freshman members, all of them moderates, who co-authored an op-ed in the Washington Post that said, we must begin an impeachment inquiry because this abuse of power cannot stand. And so the launching of this inquiry was really initiated by moderates. Adam Schiff is himself regarded as fairly moderate. So she has done a really great job of keeping everybody rowing in the same direction. And I think that that is likely to continue.
Do you see any political risk for the Democrats in pursuing this and to vote for articles of impeachment and have it go to the Senate and that process then taking up a large chunk of what will be the main election year? Are you concerned about that, thinking about the outcome?
Hugely concerned, but also believe that they had to do it. I was personally opposed to impeachment prior to the Ukraine scandal because while the Mueller report certainly had a million things in it that I viewed as impeachable, I thought that the way to get rid of Trump was to beat him in an election. They were not going to remove him in the Senate, and so impeachment was ill-advised because it would hurt marginal candidates, most of whom are moderates. But the Ukraine scandal is so egregious, it is so terrible, that I believe that those authors of that post op-ed were right. The House had no choice but to take this up. And so we may suffer politically for it, but that's what they're there to do.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Matt Bennett from the Washington, D.C. think tank Third Way. I want to come back to this question of moderates inside Congress. You were talking a lot about the moderate voters, but you also mentioned the moderates inside Congress. And both parties, thinking about moderate Democrats and the few moderate Republicans there are in there. I think it's fair to say that they do take a lot of political fire. And we can just think of, like, locally here in the Syracuse area, for instance, there's John Katko and there is Anthony Brindisi, one Republican, one Democrat. And you have groups, you mentioned a couple earlier, but the one that comes to my mind is Indivisible on the left, that are put constant pressure on them. And I had the co-founder of the Indivisible group on this program a few weeks ago. And I was asking him about that and talking about, well, you know, why are you pressuring John Katko? How do you see that playing out in the future? And he basically made the argument that Dana Balter, his challenger in the last cycle, made, which was that, you know, well, Katko's only a moderate on the surface and, well, you know, he's really more of a true Republican and, you know, Brindisi we'll see kind of thing. What's your take on the effect on the political system of those kinds of groups and what it's doing, if anything, to the dynamics of how Congress is working?
Well, there's no question that Congress has become, like the rest of the country, much more polarized. In part, it's because so many districts are impossibly red or blue. You simply can't lose those districts if you're a Democrat or Republican. And the ones that remain tend to be the ones that are in play in these elections. Just to give you some sense of it, the Squad, which is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ilhan Omar and others, those four districts, Hillary won those districts by 78, 81, 83, and 87% of the vote. I mean, those districts are navy blue,
right?
Syracuse blue. And so the people that are going to be on the front lines of these races are the people in swing districts that are not like this one, that are not nearly as partisan in their constitution. And so they're the ones that take all the heat over everything. Groups that are pushing them, I think, look, they're part of the process, but they can become very destructive. If you look at the way the Tea Party started to operate.
And Indivisible, by the way, is consciously modeled on the Tea Party.
Tea Party, right. Yeah. And I think that there's some real danger there, because what happened with the Tea Party is moderate Republicans, they're like the buffalo. They used to roam the plains in great numbers, and they were hunted into near extinction. There's a real risk of that happening to Democrats. Thankfully, it isn't happening yet. Of the 40 net seats that Democrats picked up in 2018, 33 of the 40 were endorsed by the House New Democrats. The New Democrats have their largest enrollment ever. The over 100 members of the Democratic Conference are New Democrats. And so there's a lot of them out there. But that could change if progressive groups aren't focused on fighting what I believe to be the real enemy, which is Trump and his enablers, and instead turn their fire on Democrats.
Yeah, and to come back to something we talked about earlier, I want to come back to the effect of primaries on these members of Congress and give you one specific example and then the question that comes out of that. But again, the backdrop is that primaries get lower turnout. They tend to attract more people on the edges, but you already gave a compelling argument as to why moderates may be more important there than people realize. But I was at, as an observer, a convention in New Hampshire over the weekend, and it featured a stage, among other things, a panel of these more moderate members of Congress from both the Democrat and the Republican side. And they were all talking about the primaries. I mean, that's what they were talking about. And so I take that, and then I think about the New York State Senate, which in the last cycle moved very decisively to the left, largely because there was this chunk of moderate Democrats who lost primaries to people that were more on the left, including one here in Syracuse. So is it – I mean, do these members just need to talk to you and your organization and realize that, you know, they may be overblowing in their mind the fact that they're always looking over their shoulder for these challenges? Because you're making an argument that – really, the moderates may be more important than they realize.
Well, no, I don't think they're overblowing the challenge. I assume you were at the No Labels conference.
Yeah, problem solvers.
Right, the problem solvers. And so take Josh Gottheimer, who's an old friend of mine. He is the Democratic co-chair of that organization in Congress, and he holds a seat right on the New Jersey border with New York City. It's a very affluent community, but it's also got 20% of it is farmland, so it was very red. His predecessor was a Tea Party-level Republican. And so he is at risk both from the left and the right because he's got a whole bunch of Wall Streeters in his district, and, you know, he needs to keep them happy, and he has to worry about the people that used to vote for Scott Garrett, the guy that he beat. So that's a very tough place to live if you're Josh. And he has five challengers in his primary. Now, he is likely to win. He has more money. He has more name ID. And because there isn't a movement on the left that is as accomplished as the Tea Party became very quickly on the right at knocking off incumbents like Josh. So my hope and expectation is that most of those moderate members on the left, at least on the Democratic side, will beat their primary opponents and kind of put that behind them. But his co-chair, Tom Reed in New Jersey, he's in real peril because Republicans do knock off their leaders all the time. And so that, I think, has contributed to a serious problem. So I would say it's a It's a full-blown epidemic on the Republican side, and it's a risk on the Democratic side.
So we've got just a couple minutes left. I want to broaden the conversation here and take a look kind of at America and the demographics here that may argue against some of the things you're arguing for. I wanted to get your reaction to it. But there's this phenomenon, and I'm sure that you're quite aware of it, called the Great Sort. You know, and the idea here is that one of the drivers of the political polarization that you've been talking about is the fact that people are increasingly geographically locating themselves among other people that are similar to them politically, so that it's not so much that districts get gerrymandered, it's that citizens are gerrymandering themselves. So if that is going on, and this increasingly limits the circles we travel in, where we live, the people we encounter, and reinforces these partisan divides and loyalties, where's the big picture of this going? It seems to be maybe that the problem that you are setting forward is just going to get worse and the moderates are going to get weaker. If you can address that in a minute.
Sure. Look, the Big Sort is the core problem in American politics. There's no question. And you're right. It is more responsible than gerrymandering for the very partisan makeup of most districts. That said, the likelihood is that most voters don't want super ideological people running this country. There's a group called More in Common that did an enormous study that I'm sure you're familiar with. That looked at that kind of divided the country into seven ideological segments. And basically what they found was 67% of the public, notwithstanding the fact that they live around people who agree with them, they called them the exhausted majority because they can't stand the partisanship on the extremes. What they want is kind of a return to what seems like normalcy. It's not to say that they're not going to vote for their preferred candidates, but they would rather those people do things that strike them as a little bit more relevant to their lives.
So we will see about all this. We'll have to have you back on after the election, and we can see how your predictions fared out.
I hope they come out right, but either way, I'm happy to come back.
All right, great. That was Matt Bennett from Third Way. Matt, good to talk to you again, as always.
Thank you, Bradley.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Associate producers include Sarah Forland and Zane Aga. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit us online at wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations or download the show as a podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.